You are what you read. Now, if this seems to you to be not that exciting or relevant a topic as many others, I think it is one of the most important, one of the most foundational, one of the most practically helpful presentations we could possibly have. Because this is foundational, I believe, more than anything else, of all the different things that we can be involved in, this is the key to make us effective. I've had quite a number of people ask, you know, what is the secret? How have you managed to write so many books? Or how did you manage to achieve some of these things or get these ideas? Well, I mean, it's very simple, brought down to its most irreducible, most basic. It is my parents invested in me a love of reading. And my parents really believed in books. We had a library, we read books, and I was reading from a very young age. My mother taught me to read before I went to school. And I went to school as somebody who could already read and write, and I loved books. I was, I think, 10 years old, and I was already reading the adult books. I'd already gone out of the Famous Five and the Secret Seven and Animal Adventures and Biggles books, and I was starting to read the Arthur Haley's and all the other different modern books. Of course, my family wasn't Christian, so I wasn't reading Christian books, but I was reading. And I'd read history books, and I'd read geography books, and I'd study maps, and I'd just be into books in every different ways. My first ministry when I was converted was books. I ran the book table at our church. In fact, I've taken book tables so seriously that I've had book tables everywhere, and I can't go anywhere around the world without book tables, which is one reason why I've sometimes had serious back injuries, because in the army, in the infantry, we used to lug mortar bombs and extra ammunition, and in God's army, I'm always lugging books. And it doesn't matter where I'm going, whether it's Australia, Canada, the US, Sudan, Mozambique, we're always taking books. And book tables are everywhere. I had quite a battle with my mother-in-law, future mother-in-law, just before our wedding, because I wanted to have a book table at the wedding service. And my mother-in-law had quite a fit over this, thinking, how on earth can you do that? So I made a serious compromise. We gave a rose to every lady who arrived, and we gave a copy of my most recent book at that time, The Southwest Africa Report, to every man who came to the wedding. So we've actually got a picture of me sitting next to my brother in the front of the church waiting for my wife, who was 20 minutes late. And you could see behind the men all sitting there with the Southwest Africa Report all the way through the church. And I believe in books, and you are what you read. It is said that you are what you eat. And to a degree, if you eat junk food, it's going to badly affect your body. But if you are what you eat, you're far more what you read, because you're more than a body. Your mind and your soul, what you feed your mind and your soul, is more important than what you feed your body. Important though your body is, your soul and your mind is more important, because that's going to last forever. Your character, your memory, your choices, these things. Invest in books. A reading Christian is a growing Christian. Napoleon used to walk amongst his officers, his generals, handing out books. Napoleon used to say, if you want to lead, you must read. And that's definitely true. I believe in redeeming the time. Carry a book with you, carry a New Testament in your pocket, have a Bible, have a notebook, always be ready with a pen and paper, have some newsletters or magazines in your jacket pocket. I mean, one reason why these kind of half jackets have become almost a uniform for me is because it's got all these pockets. You can have different tracks, different languages in the pockets, all kinds of different things, either for reading for me or for evangelism, handing over to others. Very useful. Even got a back pouch where you can slide newsletters and magazines, which you can pull out easier. So it's basically a battle jacket for literature evangelism. You are what you read. Some years ago, George and Alec Gallup undertook an exhaustive investigation as to what makes some people more successful than others. And using the polling techniques that had made them famous, the brothers researched and wrote a book entitled The Great American Success Story. Now, there's no doubt America is the most successful country in the world, in all of history, in any way you want to look at it. From economics to military, whatever definition you want to use, America is the success story of the world. And one of their conclusions was, successful people read. And by the way, when Alec de Tocqueville wrote his famous 1830 book on democracy in America, He noted that America had the highest literacy rate in the world. I mean, at that stage, all the schools in America were effectively home schools and church schools. There was no such thing as a government school in 1830. It was all church schools, home schools, community schools run by the local church and so on. And what did he find? Literacy rate was 99%. Illiteracy was unheard of in America. All Americans were literate. And he was stunned by it because there was no country in the world that came close to America for literacy. So one thing that makes a country successful is a very high degree of literacy. You will find all over the world the degree of literacy goes along with the standard of living to a large extent. George Gallup found that reading was essential. Successful people read. And reading is essential because reading makes a person ready to converse. These people have a broad knowledge and more information with which to make evaluations and decisions. The more you read, the better you can think. The more information you've got available, and the more options you've got to make better decisions, wiser evaluations. I mean, everything's interconnected here. You feed your mind, you're going to find that you will do better in every way. Reading is to the mind what exercise is to the body. Books are minds alive on the shelves. Look at your library as your gym equipment for your mind. By taking up one of these books and opening it, we can hear the voices of people far away in time and space. By reading, we can hear great people of long ago speaking to us mind to mind, heart to heart. If it was announced that Martin Luther or John Calvin or Charles Spurgeon or David Livingston was going to speak from a particular church, Christians from all over the world would show up. I mean, people would fly from the other side of the world just for that one event. But we need to remember that when we open up a book by one of those authors, we can hear them speak and learn from them in a greater way than you could if you just heard them at a single meeting. Some people who have read some of my books know me better than people who work with me daily or people who may come to a course. Because, you know, your books, there's more packed into a book than you could possibly pack into a seminar. Seminars have a certain ability, but books have another ability to reach us and teach us. A man is known by the company he keeps. The Bible says bad company corrupts good character. But it's also true that a person's character is to a large extent developed by the books he reads, or in the case of today, the magazines the person reads. A man is known by the company his mind keeps. What company is your mind keeping? If it's personality, Cosmo, Femina, National Enquirer, well, you can imagine what brilliant exercise that is for the mind. A man is known by the company his mind keeps. A book is good company. The reading of good books is like conversation with the finest minds of past century. In books lies the soul of the whole past time. Imagine that you've got the soul of previous centuries and nations and movements right there available to interact with you. Mark Twain observed, the man who does not read good books has no advantage over the man who cannot read them. I mean, you've got all those people out there who are illiterate. And then you've got all these people in the West who are literate, who've got access to all these books, who've got a library just around the corner, but they don't read. So what advantage is there over the person who's illiterate with a guy who is literate, but he doesn't use his literacy? Just like we saw our brother Jacques who came here, he's at a previous summit, in a wheelchair on Saturday. He doesn't have legs, but boy, he's living a more full life than a lot of people who do have legs. Why? There's a bunch of people who, you know, you might as well chop their legs off. They're not using them. They're just sitting like couch potatoes there, working the remote and clicking mouses, and they're not actually getting out there and doing anything with their legs, so why on earth do they even have them? You could start talking about whether some people use their minds or not, but let's not go there. Abraham Lincoln commented, the things I want to know are in books. My best friend is the man who will get me a book I have not read. Walt Disney said, there is more treasure in books than in all the pirates' loot on Treasure Island. And best of all, you can enjoy these riches every day of your life. And by the way, that's where Walt Disney got all those great films, all those great things that built up the Disney empire. He got them out of classic books. Treasure Island, Pinocchio. I mean, he didn't conjure them out of his mind. He took them out of books, and the books enabled him to produce some of the greatest films and some of the most impressive picture animated films ever seen. To him, the books were the treasure. He discovered treasure in those old books and gave them to a new generation through these films. And so it's true. There's more treasure in books than there is in loot on Treasure Island. In a very real sense, people who have read good literature have lived more than people who cannot or who will not read. It is not true that we have only one life to live. If we read, we can live as many more lives and as many kinds of lives as we wish. If you encounter a person of rare intellect, you should ask him what books he reads. That was the advice of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Find out what books, when you find someone who's successful in the realm that you're interested in, you know, if you think that golf's the most important thing, find out what Tiger Woods reads. What kind of golfing books does he read? If to you the most important thing is skydiving, you want to find out what skydivers are reading. If you want to be effective in missions, you want to find out what George Verver and Patrick Johnson and other mission leaders read. Find out what are the best books that have made the most successful people in that field effective. Then those are the books you want to get into. Charles Spurgeon counseled the students, master those books that you have. Read them thoroughly. Bathe in them until they saturate you. Read and reread them. Digest them. A student will find that his mental constitution is more affected by one book thoroughly mastered than by 20 books he has merely skimmed. You know, it's not the volume of books. It's not the amount of books that you can say, you know, I've got through 60 books this year. But if you've mastered 10 books, that's far more valuable than having skimmed through 60. I mean, get a book, go through it, and as Charles said, go through it with your pen. I mean, mark up your books. My books, my Bibles are full of notes. I make notes all the way through. To me, I have a red pen, I've got a black pen, I've got my ruler, and I'm going through and I'm marking them up, and I can go back exactly and find the place I want, and it helps memorization, it helps location. It organizes in your mind, because if you're just passively reading, you're not getting as far. When you're actively reading and identifying, this is the key point, marking in the margin your code as to the subjects, sometimes writing in the back the different references to this or that subject, you really get to master it. And after a while, that's your book. Now it's a textbook. It's not just some arbitrary book out there where you've got to scour through thousands of words to find. You can just glance through and you can immediately find all the key highlights, the key points, maybe written at the back, the action items you intended to do on it, and other things that the Lord spoke to you about while you were traveling. As I go through my Bible, I've got dates in different parts in the margins. There's some dates where it'll say on this date how the Lord spoke to me on that, and I go through and I suddenly remember, yes, I remember how the Lord spoke to me at that date. And sometimes conviction comes because I realize, whoa, I have forgotten and drifted from that, and it pulls me back. Other times, it just gives such praise, and I think, wow, that's where I reached the fork in the road, and by God's grace, he took me down this way. I praise God I didn't continue on that low road. Took the high road, and so on. Daniel Webster recommended that it's better to master a few books than to read indiscriminately. It was his contention that to master a few great writers was preferable to skimming a multitude of lesser works. I mean, make no mistake, there's a lot of junk out there. There's a lot of great stuff out there, too. So let's choose the great stuff. C.S. Lewis recommended, if one must read only the new or the old, I would advise them to read the old. It's a good rule after reading a new book never to allow yourself another new one until you've read an old one in between. Why is he saying that? Don't assume that new is better. Just because there's something new on the market doesn't. Sometimes it is earth-shaking, but you know, in the long haul, when you go over the whole thing, some things that are new look, wow, this is great, this is new, this is tremendous. I can promise you that a century from now, the prayer of Jabez is not going to be on the reading list of anyone. It's a phenomenon that bursts bright for a short time, and another generation, if they even know of the existence of it, will be astounded as to what all the hoopla was at the time. The other books, we look back, and I mean, we know Shakespeare stands out. Shakespeare's works are remarkable. C.S. Lewis's books are just standing out there. There are some books of the past. When you look at a first millennium, they say there's no doubt that the greatest theologian of the first millennium of the church was St. Augustine. I mean, Augustine just is head and shoulders above the rest. And in the second millennium, John Calvin just stands out. In the last five centuries, nobody has improved on the Institutes of Biblical the Institutes of the Christian Religion, written by John Calvin, which he started writing in his early 20s, by the way. It was meant to be a letter to the King of France, and he just got a bit carried away, and it turned out to be the most systematic theology of the Christian faith ever produced, and it's never been improved on. And maybe people at the time didn't fully grasp that, but as time went on, looking back, they've seen it hasn't been eclipsed. Or Martin Luther's Bondage of the Will. There's some books that just, they tower above all others. Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. It must be one of the most translated, most read books in the centuries of the Christians. The Pilgrim's Progress, written by the Puritan John Bunyan. So some books just tower. Fox's Book of Martyrs was required reading in Sunday schools at one time because it was just so foundational on the testimonies of the people who suffered in the Christian faith. If we've never read the originals, you know, might have read some modern little short, zippy, edited, diluted version of David Livingstone's life. It's not quite as powerful as reading the original Missionary Travels in South Africa by David Livingstone. If you've read the original Livingstone's Travels, wow, do you have an advantage over those who have only read the modern, sanitized, politically correct versions. For example, when I started reading about David Livingstone, I didn't know that David Livingstone was Reformed. I didn't know that David Livingstone had been influenced by William Wilberforce's Practical Christianity book. I wouldn't have got that from the modern ones. I sure didn't know that David Livingstone carried a six-barreled revolver, which in the 1940s was the most advanced weapon around, or double-barreled rifle, elephant gun, and that he used them to free slaves from the slave traders. The confrontations of Livingstone with Islamic slave traders just isn't in the modern biographies of David Livingstone because it's considered controversial. I mean, the guy used force against Muslim slave raiders. So this is for the pacifists of today, these wimpish, weedy, wet little pacifist Christians of today. Their hair stands on end, they all have heart failure when they read that. So that's been censored out. And if you want to read a modern, diluted, politically correct version of Livingstone's life, you're going to miss all the fun stuff. So go to the source, get the original stuff, and it's so much more enjoyable. Well, inferior books are to be rejected in an age and a time when we're courted by whole libraries. No man's life is long enough to read even those which are good and great and famous. Why then should we waste the time with lesser works when some of the greatest are available? Example, how much time do we spend reading newspapers and magazines? And I promise you, the bulk of the stuff you read in newspaper magazines don't matter much, and a couple of months from now, it doesn't mean a thing. It's so temporary, so transient, because they're so often so inaccurate. I mean, the day-to-day newspaper and so on, it's not as effective as when you get the long haul and you get someone who's written a sweep of history. You can read a book in the same time it would have taken you to read a few magazines and a couple of newspapers, and you've got something that's going to stand you in good stead and strengthen you and make you an effective person for longer. Many people say, I don't have time to read. Actually, that's not true. They're reading emails, they're reading magazines, they're reading newspapers, but they don't have time for books. Ditch the newspapers and the magazines for a few months, read a couple of great books, and just see the difference. I mean, just try. There's some people who've tried switching off the TV for a month, and then they've been astounded. I mean, they actually have done studies on this where people have been paid to do this, and they switch off the TV for a month or whatever, and they all reported at the end how family relations had improved, how reading had improved, how just so many improvements. But you know the incredible thing about this particular report in Time magazine was that every one of those families who reported on the immense improvements of switching off TV for a month, they all went back to it. It just shows human nature sometimes really can't learn the lesson. But just think how much time you read inferior drivel, and then just don't have the time to get to the good, great, life-changing, spectacular, monumental, history-making books. And we really need to start there. Francis Bacon wrote, some books are to be tasted, others to be swallowed, and some few are to be chewed and digested. Read the best books first, or you may not have the chance to read them at all. Many times the reading of the book has made the future of the man. I can tell you the amount of times when, by God's grace, I just happened to read the right book just before I needed that, and it made all the difference. I remember going through Who Moved the Stone by Morris. He was one of these pagan, atheist, anti-Christian characters who wanted to prove that Christianity was false. So he went into disproving the resurrection. He decided, okay, Paul said everything in Christianity hangs on a resurrection. Let me disprove the resurrection, which should be easy as it comes, and then, hey presto, I will have destroyed Christianity. So he starts to investigate, and he goes thoroughly into all the facts. And at the end, he gets converted and writes a book, Who Moved the Stone? And he is converted by investigating the facts. Another example, Simon Greenleaf, considered the evidentialist of all times. He spoke the final word when it came to Supreme Court interpretation of evidence. When it comes to the rules of evidence in any law school, Simon Greenleaf will stand up there head and shoulders above all the others. Skeptic, real pagan, despised Christianity, but one of his key principles is you never make a judgment until you've seen all the evidence. So at one point, one of his students challenged him about his views on Christianity, and he made his dismissive anti-Christian comments, and a student said, but sir, have you investigated the evidence? And Simon Greenleaf said he lost enough face to sell all the tea in China, some strange term like that. He realized he had not looked at any of the evidence. Forget about all the evidence. I mean, here he had just violated his number one rule that he had been teaching all his students, never make a judgment until you investigate the evidence. So Simon Greenleaf was shamed into doing an investigation to rules of evidence for the resurrection and for the Bible and for the different claims of Christianity. And he ended up being radically converted and became one of the most vigorous proponents for Christianity and said, the Bible is the best attested to document in all of history. The resurrection is the best attested to fact in ancient history. And he went through time, point after point, and he said there is not a court of law in the Western world that would not have to admit that the resurrection is an established fact, established more than any other legal point that you can make for anything that happened 1,000 years ago. There's no book in the world that's got more manuscript evidence and so on and so forth. And he went through all the different evidences and was converted. Josh McDowell was one of these cocky little humanist law students in university who thought the key to Christianity is resurrection, disprove the resurrection, and you've killed Christianity, investigated, got converted by the evidence, and has become one of the main proponents, evidence that demands a verdict. I remember reading Evidence That Demands a Verdict before I needed it, and a whole lot of key cases where people needed to be brought to the Lord, and just how well that prepared me. So there's many different times when the reading of the book has made the future of the man. I know that books have often been absolutely critical. If I hadn't read some key books before some certain battles we had, I would have lost those battles, and history would have been pretty different in the case of our mission. Employ your time in improving yourself by other men's writings so that you shall come easy by what others have labored hard for. I mean, think about it. If you know what goes into a book, I mean, sometimes you've got a lifetime of experience, a lifetime of study. These guys have put months, if not years, into the actual writing of this book. And for a small price and a few hours, you can get the cream of what this person has just been really intensely working for years through his life. I mean, that's extraordinary. It's like, if you could move it to the body side, it's as though you could suddenly acquire Arnold Schwarzenegger's body for a couple of hours PT. You know, this is an incredibly good deal. You get some of the finest minds' conclusions on some of the toughest issues, and you can get it for a few hours' work. This guy might have put thousands of hours into this book, and you can get it for a few hours' reading. So Socrates says, employ your time in improving yourself by other men's writing so you can come easily by what others have labored hard for. Next to the Holy Scriptures, the greatest aid to the life of faith may be Christian biographies. I tell you, you need to read widely. You need to read some history. You need to read doctrine. You need to read subjects on that subject you're interested in, whether it's creation science or government or economics. But also make sure biographies are part of your diet, because in biographies, you get examples that are really going to help you in your devotional life, in your personal adventure of discipleship. The reading of good biographies forms an important part of a Christian's education. It provides him with numberless illustrations for use in his own service. He learns to assess the true worth of character, to glimpse a work goal for his own life, to decide how best to attain it, what self-denial is needed to curb unworthy aspirations. And all the time, he learns how God breaks into the dedicated life to bring about his own purposes. So biographies are invaluable. Biographies transmit personality. Who can gauge the inspiration to the cause and missions of great biographies like those of William Carey, Adoniram Judson, Hudson Taylor, Charles Studd? Well, I know in my own life, these people have been immeasurable inspirations and helps, especially in the hard times. When you see what they went through, many a time where I would have given up remembering or reading what these guys went through, and you realize actually what I'm going through is nothing compared to what they're going through. And it just gives you, it picks you up and you soar past obstacles that would have stopped you. I must say, biographies of these great missionaries and Christian leaders and reformers of the past have, in my life, been absolutely invaluable. History is but the lengthy shadows of great men. Those that love reading have everything within their reach. For a small price, you can visit other lands and great periods of history. You can learn from some of the greatest minds and world shapers, grapple with great issues, learn in a space of a few hours what others have grappled with, researched, and studied for their whole lives. Now, this presentation is taken from a chapter in the Discipleship Handbook, and word for word, you'll get this all in the Discipleship Handbook.